interview segment of our program. I'm sitting here today with John Rappaport. He's an investigative reporter who's been covering health-related issues. And he's having a get-together coming the end of October, what, the 24th?
Saturday night the 24th.
Saturday night the 24th. I wanted to plug that right at the top of the show just so you're aware of it. We'll give you more details later on. The first segment, we're going to do five segments here, so you'll be seeing them in succession. First segment we're going to do is about neuropsycholeptic drugs.
They're called different things. One is neuroleptic, major tranquilizers, antipsychotics. They're basically the same kind of drug.
And these are drugs that we're all on some level familiar with. I think probably the most famous one is Thorazine. Others that I've heard of are Haldol and Melaril. Is that one of them?
Melaril is another one, yes.
I think those are probably the most commonly prescribed ones. And what we usually think of them as being used for is the control of the violently insane. People that are going to hurt themselves or somebody else if you don't straitjacket them some way or another. But the drugs, I'm telling the whole story here, I should let you cut in. The drugs are actually cause permanent brain damage.
They do. There are about 20 of them. They started being used in 1954. Thorazine was the first one. And they are called a chemical straitjacket. They have that sort of vegetating effect on people. But what was not really known for a while, although it's now been known for quite some time, is that they do cause brain damage by cutting certain pathways in the brain. And these are the same pathways that are cut by a neurotransmitter called dopamine. That is, dopamine creates these neural pathways in the brain. These neuroleptic drugs block those pathways. And those are the same pathways that lobotomy actually surgically cuts. This is what's been hidden from people, from patients, from even some doctors, that this is really what these drugs are doing. And as you say, the myth was, well, we have a few isolated people, you know, that we have to control because they're so violent. But when you start adding up how many prescriptions are really written in the United States now, you realize that they're used over a tremendous breadth of people. Outpatient clinics, nursing homes, hospitals, psychiatrists' offices, mental institutions, they're spread around everywhere.
And the thing is, the drug was never, or this class of drug, was never intended to be therapy, per se, but just something to help the staff in the institution control the patient.
Absolutely.
So there's no curative value to this.
No.
And they don't even try and say that there is.
Well, they do.
Oh, okay.
This is the fantasy. This is where you find the... It's a frequent contradiction when you get to very toxic drugs. You know, they'll say, yes, we have studies that show that this drug is extremely specific for this type of, quote, brain disease, which is a fiction. There is no brain disease that they've actually located. Mm-hmm. They invent this idea, and then they say we've got the cure for it. But truthfully, as you say, all the research was done to interfere with these neurotransmitter pathways. So if you're going to say this is a cure, this would be like saying if you have a pain in your leg, we're going to cure it by putting your leg in a permanent cast. And the constant injections of Novocaine, that way you won't feel the pain anymore, and that's a cure. So it's about that specific. That's what we're talking about.
It's dealing with the symptom and not with the cause.
Right. And it's dealing with the symptom by completely obliterating the whole area, you know. Let's get rid of that, you know, we want to bomb that location down there, so let's take out the jungle, you know, for 16 miles all around is kind of the real philosophy behind this.
Or there's a mosquito on your cheek, so let's take it out with a sledgehammer.
Exactly, and these drugs are definite sledgehammers.
So how is it that these things are on the market?
Well, this is where my interest came in, because I have been doing a lot of research on the FDA versus alternative health. It's getting to be fairly common knowledge now that the FDA is trying to block alternative medical practitioners from practicing medicine that is a little bit off the beaten track, or from doing research that's a little bit off the beaten track. It's trying to control the food supplement industry in a very big way. So that's how I kind of came into this. But I eventually saw that the real scandal of the FDA had to do with the drugs that they license on a routine basis. And that if you looked at the quality and the effect of these drugs, then you would understand what kind of agency this actually was. That it wasn't just an agency with little squabbles about, well, they're getting a little bit too heavy-handed with vitamins or herbs. You know, they should be a little more tolerant of people who are into alternative health. This is just not true. They are a much more sinister agency than anyone really suspects. And this is how you find out.
So they're not just worried about people being sold massive doses of vitamins that aren't going to help them, or actually hurt them, probably.
No.
But they're not really concerned, and what you're saying is they're not really concerned about the consumer's well-being, about him being ripped off by somebody that says, oh, if you take 3 grams of vitamin C, that it'll cure a cold or prevent colds or something like that. What they're interested in is actually interfering with our ability to be responsible for our own health.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. They're saying, we don't want you to take care of your health this way with vitamins, supplements. We don't want you to try to, God forbid, consider that some mental upset or problem could be caused by deficiencies of nutrients or some imbalance in that way. No. What we want you to do is go to a psychiatrist and take these drugs, which we've licensed, and here they are, and they're called neuroleptics. And so when you do that, well, here's the story from...
Yeah, how do these drugs get licensed? Is that what you're leading up to?
There are many, many studies that are done. Usually you start off with what's called animal safety studies. Now, many people think these are almost completely irrelevant, and they cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And you take, let's say, several hundred or several thousand animals, and you give them dosages of a drug, and you find the amount of the drug at which half the animals die. That's called the LD50.
A lethal dose.
Lethal dose for 50% of the animals that you're involved with. So once you've established that, then they say, okay, the FDA says, very good, now we see what the toxicity levels are for animals. Now we want you to do a bigger study with animals to prove that the drug has efficacy for this type of problem. So now the researchers say, okay, now we've got to give animals this brain problem, which of course we've invented and is a fiction, since we're not really sure what it is that we're saying that humans have, so we have to give this to animals.
And depression is kind of a hard thing to induce in an animal.
Yes. I mean, shall we hit them over the head with hammers? Shall we starve them? Shall we give them chemicals that are going to put them into a vegetative state? Shall we, you know, what shall we do? Well, there are many answers to this, and they figure out some protocol. This is all very scientific sounding. So now you've got a room full of depressed experimental animals by their definition. Now let's give them some of these, or let's say, instead of depressed, because we're talking about major tranquilizers here, let's say that they are out of control. So maybe they've given them amphetamines, or maybe they've given them poisons to put them into a very agitated state, or who knows what. Now, with a room full of these animals, let's give them Thorazine or some version of this type of drug, and let's see if we can quiet all of them down. And lo and behold, you can increase the dose until now animals practically anesthetized, with some side effect of brain damage, which is not really a problem. And so we say, now the drug has efficacy. And the FDA says, indeed it does. This is wonderful. Now let's go to humans. Let's prove that the drug, we can find a safe dosage for human volunteers. So now we go to a university like a USC, and we get a bunch of volunteers around, and these people have mental problems that seem to fit in this category, and they're given the drug, and lo and behold, it's at a dose that doesn't seem to cause them any problems, so we call this safe. Now let's see if we can make it efficacious for these people. Another round of studies. You're talking maybe $50 million, $100 million spent on all of this just to bring the drug to market, right? So you figure that for any one of these drugs, the FDA has to license an okay, you know, I don't know, 20 studies, maybe 20 different types of studies, maybe more, and say, okay, this is fine. Now we find that years later, these drugs are causing tremendous brain damage, and in fact, we're causing it from almost the beginning.
The name of this condition, tardive dyskinesia.
Means kind of a delayed reaction of erratic motions that are uncontrollable in the body.
I looked it up in one of my textbooks, and the definition specifically mentions psycholeptic drugs. It's a specific disease or condition that's produced by the drug. So
it's very interesting because, as you can see, it's there in certain manuals and
it journals. Also basically says that it's related or similar to Parkinson's disease.
Absolutely, and to something also called lethargic encephalitis, almost exactly the same, which is kind of another brain disorder. So here are the psychiatrists, their own manuals and journals, if you look far enough, will tell you that this condition is caused by the drug. But the psychiatrists want to deny this and basically link up that symptom of uncontrollable body twitches and motions and brain damage to the, quote, brain disease, which is progressive, that they have discovered that they're treating with this drug, which gives them a fabulous out all the time. They can say, well, yes, and here's the story. In the book called Toxic Psychiatry by Peter Bragan, which lays all of this out.
He's a psychiatrist himself.
He's a psychiatrist.
Sort of a renegade, though, I guess.
Yeah, he deserted the system. He left because he was too horrified by what was going on.
Right.
A woman named Roberta, 19 years old, is going to college. She's a sophomore, very bright. She's got problems. Her problems are in the sphere of, do I want to concentrate specifically on my career and do all my work there? What about dating men? How am I going to put that into what I'm doing? And, you know, Bragan says Roberta would have been an ideal candidate for psychotherapy, talk therapy. So the health service at her university recommended she go see a psychiatrist, medical psychiatrist, which means you're talking about an MD with a further specialization, not a psychologist. He gives her a neuroleptic. So, as you can see, this is not a psychotic individual. They're not in a straitjacket. They're not in an institution. They're not violent. He gives her a neuroleptic. Now, 4 or 5 years later, and 6 psychiatrists later, who have been switching her from one neuroleptic to another as her symptoms, tardive dyskinesia, have begun worse and worse, and they are attributing this, of course, to the disease that they say she has, this biological brain disease. She is now in a position where she can no longer control many of her body movements. She has problems with her respiratory system to the degree that she can't speak without grunts and spasms. She wants to control herself, but she's got twitches and things. Her doctor is saying that she's lost 30% of her IQ. During an interview, she is banging her head uncontrollably on a file cabinet. This is what has happened to somebody purely from taking these drugs over a 4 to 6 year period. And Bragan in the book says, if she stops taking these neuroleptics for several months, she may experience a remission of some of the symptoms, but her life will never be remotely the same as it was before. So in many cases, it's permanent with ongoing use, which is defined roughly as anything from 6 months to 5 years. Although to say, therefore, we know that less than 6 months is safe would be an overstatement. So this is what we're dealing with. And here's the government agency, the FDA, that is licensing all of these drugs, not in smoke-filled rooms, but just routinely. Oh, this drug is safe. Oh, yes, it's effective. This is safe. It's effective. I've got a list of 20 of these neuroleptic drugs with names you've never heard of that have been developed and released and refined since 1954. And what Bragan says, and here's the capper that people can't really even, it's too hard to even imagine, but here it is. 1 million people in the United States now suffering from tardive dyskinesia, which means brain damage as a result of these drugs. 1 million. Roughly 300 million people around the world that have received these drugs since 1954, and of those still alive, about 38 million have this condition of brain damage, tardive dyskinesia. So Bragan says the psychiatric profession is visiting a chemical medical plague on the human race. That's how strong he makes the point.
The phrase that comes to mind is cosmetic lobotomy.
Cosmetic lobotomy, that's very good. I think that kind of gives you the... And the cosmetic part is the sort of assurances that you will get all the way along the line that the patient is being given the right drug and that everything is okay.
So I guess what we're looking at here on the other side of the coin is somehow these drugs are approved based on $100 million worth of research, and they're still not safe or effective. Well, on the other hand, they're trying to take nutritional supplements off the market, which are, you know, arguably safe. You can argue whether or not they're effective. A lot of people think they are, and I suppose if they weren't, people wouldn't be using them.
Right.
But they're trying to take those off the market, and there is no company or individual who's going to be willing to spend $100 million to prove that, say, vitamin C is safe and effective.
By that whole process that we described, that's right.
So we're not going to ever get FDA approval for it. It isn't based on whether or not it's safe and effective. It's based on whether or not somebody spends money, hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars, to get it approved.
I think what's likely to happen, if the FDA were really to go this far, let's say in the next year, and remove a substance like a vitamin above a certain potency, is what the way they work
right,
this, right?
Right.
They would take, say, vitamin C. If you manufactured it in greater than 60 milligram tablets, they might say, okay, we're going to take that off the shelf. The likelihood is that they would try to put higher potency into the hands of doctors under the fantasy that a doctor really knows what's an effective dose, and he will dole it out when it's necessary. That would be probably their strategy if they were to go for this. You're right. They are trying to say, we're protecting the public's health by looking at these potentially dangerous food supplements. While 1 million people in the country have tardive dyskinesia from these antipsychotic drugs that they're saying are perfectly safe in the hands of doctors. Mm-hmm. So you can't say, oh, this is just a mistake they're making. You know, no. This is a whole orientation that they have to try to crush the food supplement industry, put it in the hands of the pharmaceutical houses, and to promote at the same time very toxic pharmaceutical drugs. And this is one of the topics that I'm going to be discussing in more detail on October 24th, right, when we're going to try to show people, you know, the fullest possible picture of the FDA / pharmaceutical complex / AMA at the highest levels, American Medical Association /
as to what
NIH, National Institutes of Health / Centers for Disease Control, what is the ultimate agenda of all of these people? And further, what can we do about it that's going to be effective? Yes, writing letters to congressmen and all of that, everybody seems to know by now that you've got to do these things and that they are effective. But when you spell out the real, and I have to use the word evil, of this empire, you're now talking about a degree of activism that has got to be much more profound and long-term. So this is what we want to try to light a fire under people with.
The government or somebody has been trying to get things removed, nutritional, natural products removed from the market for a long time. It's a battle that keeps coming back. But it seems like they're really stepping it up now all of a sudden.
Indeed they are.
And, well, I don't know how paranoid you have to be to try and, like you say, figure out, well, what is the agenda here, you know? Based on all of these facts, what is the logical thing that they're trying to achieve?
This is the jumping off point right there. When you see that, then you begin to think in a different way. It's no longer just an economic war or just incompetence or stupidity. Something else got to be involved here, and the larger picture, I think, there's more information that we can actually supply on this, and that's basically what we're going to try to do.
So why don't you give us a little bit more detail on where and when this is going to be?
October 24th, which is a Saturday night, in Santa Monica at the John Adams School, which is at the corner of 16th and Pearl Streets. And the room holds 600 people. We want standing room only. We'd like to see lots of people show their faces there and be part of this situation. And people can call a phone number if they want further information.
Go ahead.
It's 213-667-1989.
213-667-1989.
But basically, we would like to see them show up on the 24th of October, 7:30, John Adams School in Santa Monica. That's 16th and Pearl Streets. And, you know, listen to the whole picture and get some inspiration and ideas about what they can do about it.
Well, that's great. This is your opportunity. This is really an important movement that we're trying to get started or organize here. And it's really up to you, to the viewer, the consumer, to be as aware as possible of what's going on and try to get involved in a concerted effort to show the government and the pharmaceutical companies that we're not going to take it anymore.
Exactly.
Okay. Just in the way of closing here, we've talked about the use of these drugs that ultimately cause the symptoms that they're being used for, and that the drugs are approved by the FDA, even in the face of continuing scientific evidence that shows that these drugs do cause permanent brain impairment, brain damage.
That's right.
And this is our FDA. This is what our government is approving for use, not on people that are violent psychotics, but on people that are maybe a little depressed or neurotic, outpatients.
Absolutely.
Somebody with a psychological or an emotional problem can go into a psychiatrist and be given these drugs, the drugs are supposedly there for to fight an organic condition, some kind of abnormality in your brain.
This is the definition, that's right. And it's called the biopsychiatric view. It's basically psychiatric profession putting themselves in the hands of the drug company. The profession was going down the drain for lack of interest in money at one point about 15 years ago. And so the wing of the psychiatric profession that was inclined toward this biopsychiatric view of things and away from talk therapy, saying the past is unimportant, what's happened to you is unimportant, all that's important is brain chemistry. This has been their move, and they are now virtually, you know, in debt to the drug companies who control this profession.
I think it was Peter Bragan was saying that American Psychological or Psychiatric Association or some such professional organization of psychiatrists received $1 million from the Upjohn company, which produces these kind of drugs.
Such as Xanax, one of the most popular drugs in the world now, psychiatric drugs. And Bragan shows how actually at every step of the way, in the approval of that drug, there were people involved who were paid consultants to Upjohn. The editor of the journal in which the study was published that resulted in the licensing of the drug, the psychiatrist, the doctor that they hired to shepherd the drug through the program of approval, employees in a sense.
The FDA has a record of a revolving door, similar to what we've heard of in the Pentagon, where people who are responsible for approving these drugs turn around and get jobs working for the companies that they approve the drugs for, with salaries that are maybe four or five times what they were getting from the government.
And they own stock and pharmaceutical companies and all of that sort of thing. Another interesting statistic that I came across was Thorazine in 1977. There were over 4.5 million prescriptions written for Thorazine in the United States or worldwide. I'm not sure of which figure, but it doesn't really matter because it's so immense anyway. So we would be talking about huge numbers of people, and this is just one neuroleptic.
It's like one out of every 50 people in the country.
Yeah. You know, I have to believe this is an international figure, although when you break it down, I mean, how many prescriptions does one person get written in 1 year? It's a number of prescriptions, but still, you're talking about 200 and some odd million tablets of Thorazine. So, and that's just one of the neuroleptics out of, let's say, 20 or 25. So this is not just, you know, the fantasy that we've been entertaining as far as these drugs are concerned. It's huge.
So I guess basically, in the worst case scenario, these drugs are great tools for controlling the minds of mass populations, for anybody that is into doing that sort of thing.
Yes, it's a perfect, you know, first you define the terms of the game by saying, we are the profession, psychiatry, backed up by the FDA, who is supporting us and giving us carte blanche to issue any drugs pretty much that we want to. We are the profession who decides what the mind is, what the brain really does, what thinking is all about, what insanity means, what a mental problem really is. And we're going to define it in such a way that we're going to say social conditions, political conditions have nothing to do with why a person would be, quote, disturbed. Because we can obviously see that in a situation where there is some great upheaval, only a certain small fraction of people go out and commit crimes. Everyone else stays at home. Therefore, we know that there must be some brain disease that these criminals are carrying around with them, and we're going to treat those with our exquisitely specific drugs, which in reality, of course, is like having a safe fall on your head. That's how exquisitely specific they are. And so we now have a profession that says we're in charge of defining, in a sense, what crime is, what insanity is, what a mental problem is, what sanity is, what normalcy are. You know, all of these factors suddenly you begin to see as the profession gains more power, hey, these guys have a tremendous amount of idea power and drug power put together here. They can actually say to you,
they don't have
you're
to,
disturbed.
They don't even have to wait until you become a criminal. They can just say, well, you've got criminal tendencies.
You will become a criminal.
Yeah,
right?
So,
and we're going to help you.
Yeah.
In 5, 4, 3.
Well, welcome back again for our second segment of interview with John Rappaport. Thanks for joining us in this segment. We were talking at the end last time about how what the FDA and our medical establishment is doing to in terms of given all these things that they're doing, what does it suggest that they're really up to, or that somebody's really up to? And I pointed out that the psycholeptic drugs are an example of that, what should we say, totalitarian forces might exert control over mass populations by their ability to reason for themselves, ultimately. You can produce zombies with this stuff.
Yeah, you do produce zombies with it. And you can also control social and political situations by deciding who needs it. You know, who do we think really needs this? For example, there's now a situation, it's called the Violence Initiative, which was put forward by Fred Goodwin, who was the highest ranking psychiatrist in the country. And without going into a long explanation of it, what he basically said was that in 1994, the most important funding in the field of psychiatric research is going to be the Violence Initiative, which is an attempt to intervene with 4-year-old and 5-year-old inner city kids and find so-called genetic or biological markers that would show that they will later commit violent criminal acts, and therefore ultimately you would be able to intervene. And the intervention, of course, would be drugs at 4 or 5 years old. Well, this caused such an uproar that now he's backpedaling, but this does not mean that it's going away. This is not a new idea. This has been around for a long time.
They're selecting out inner city youth.
Inner city youth.
Because we figure, well, those kids are violent anyway. There's more violence in the inner city, so maybe it's the inner city youth has some genetic problem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, a small fraction, they would say. They would say, see, what we want to do is find those individuals that really are going to be violent. Now, the science behind this, which is really pseudoscience, is that they have definitely discovered the reason why people commit spontaneous violent acts. It's because they have too little of a brain neurotransmitter called serotonin. Now, this is not so. I mean, this has not been established, but by making inferences that are not warranted, you can build a case for it. Therefore, naturally, you would want to give them a drug that produced more serotonin to cut down their spontaneous violent impulses. Well, the first of a whole series of the market now that has hit that does this is called, guess what, Prozac. Now, Prozac is actually given as a kind of, tranquilizer or antidepressant, actually, to people. But here is this other use, supposedly, for it. And we know now that it's just standing there as the first in a whole line of drugs that are aimed at the market. So you can see that this is not just some fanciful idea that somebody had. This is a concerted effort to try to control people down to very young, small kids with drugs, with And the the side effects of something like Prozac can be horrendous. I mean, you can get all kinds of reactions in certain people that take it, from suicidal reactions to violent behavior, another instance of the drug producing what it's supposedly curing.
Yeah, and then their rationale is that, well, obviously we're giving this drug to people who have a tendency towards suicide or violence towards others, and you can expect that the drug isn't going to be effective on everybody, and so we'll have sporadic cases. But you can't blame the drug for it.
That's right. You can't blame us. You can't blame the drug. You can't blame the FDA that licensed the drug. And now we get down to the same question again. What is this agency that has routinely okayed all of the studies on Prozac and put it on the marketplace, and the drug that has now caused such an incredible furor here and abroad about its bad side effects? What is that all about? And one of the things it's about is that the FDA never takes up the question of long-term effects. They'll do a six-week study on a psychiatric drug that has got a sledgehammer effect on people and say, sure, from 6 weeks we can tell what this drug is all about. And then they license it, and then a year down the line, people start going psycho. And you know, other people look at these people and say, well, gee, that person's crazy. You know, he needs drugs. No, he was given drugs, now he's crazy. What he needs is to get off the drugs. You have the case of, say, Ritalin, which is an upper, given to perhaps 600,000-700,000 kids in school that are supposedly, quote, unmanageable or can't really absorb their lessons. And so they're told by the school system, acting under orders from some medical personage who works for the school, little Johnny has to take Ritalin. And little Johnny's parents say, hey, we don't want him to take Ritalin. This actually happened in the New Hampshire school system. And they said, well, little Johnny's system, if he doesn't take it. And the attorney general or the district attorney of the state of New Hampshire backed this up and said, yes, the school has a right to do this, certainly. Now, the side effects from Ritalin are ridiculous. Elevated blood pressure, depression, sadness, increased heart rate, all sorts of things, sometimes suicidal tendencies.
It's not a cure for anything.
It's not a cure. In fact, what happens is, supposedly it's a cure for hyperactivity, okay? So what really happens is the hyperactive kid takes it, and at first, in some cases, there's this calming effect. But then he keeps taking it, and then in many cases you get hyperactivity, the very thing that you were trying to get rid of, right?
And sounds like homeopathy.
Right, homeopathy with a sledgehammer, right?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, we're going to give you this very minute dose of the thing that you already have. No, we're going to like triple the dose of what you might already have, but really probably don't, and then we're going to give it to you, right?
Yeah, so that it will verify our diagnosis.
So here's the FDA okaying Ritalin, right? Same idea. And this drug has been around forever. And it's been given to I don't know how many millions of people with these side effects, especially for kids. And maybe, I won't say it's the worst effect of the drug, but one of the worst effects is that the kid now believes that other people are convinced that he can't function normally, whatever that means, without a drug. And so he now can suffer, unless he's a very tough-minded kid, a lot of loss of pride in himself. He's now a drug case. You know, this kid has to have drugs in order to just get along. So now he builds up this, one possible thing that happens to kids like this is now he builds up this idea of himself as someone who needs drugs to function.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to go looking for other drugs, obviously, as he gets older.
Ones that seem to have more pleasurable effects, perhaps.
Yes, more pleasurable effects. And he's probably going to, if he stays in the hands of psychiatrists, he's certainly going to get other drugs that do not have pleasurable effects.
Mm-hmm. Well, this thing, serotonin and violence, There was a thing on PBS about gorillas a while back, and they mentioned that the alpha male, who's the leader of the pack, is his brain is swimming in serotonin because he's on top of the world. He's in control and relaxed, basically. Whereas all the other males are, their serotonin levels are way down because they're essentially oppressed. They always have to be looking over their shoulder to make sure that they're not getting in the alpha dominant male's way. So it's kind of, it gives you an interesting idea what serotonin is really all about. It's almost like the royal neurotransmitter.
And indeed.
We could see where that particular pathway, or that the function of serotonin in the brain, can be modulated to produce either very confident, calm, collected individuals, or on the other hand, you can produce a bunch of people who are easy to oppress, let's say.
Now, on top of that, you have the problem, which is that the psychiatrists would like to make it a very simple proposition. It's either increase of serotonin or decrease of serotonin, and we know which it is in order to produce which state, and we can regulate it. And we can do it without disturbing the surrounding brain areas, right? Which, all of this is baloney. There are other factors involved in leadership and violence and all of this kind of thing. And the drug Prozac, for example, will disturb other neurotransmitter systems aside from the serotonin. It'll affect dopamine and others in a kind of random, unchartable way that we have no idea about, which will produce other effects. But this is sort of downplayed, it's not really important, and so forth.
Right.
And actually, you know, I spoke with a researcher once who was doing serotonin research with monkeys at a VA facility here. And I may have this backwards, I'll have to check on this, but he was telling me that the leaders of the packs, at least I thought, had lowered serotonin levels, but maybe it's just the opposite.
I think it is higher, and I, you know, I'm not real sure either.
But this would make an interesting point here, because it's as if they're saying, well, we certainly know that when a person gets to be a leader and he's swimming in serotonin, he's certainly not going to be a violent individual, right? So let's look at George Bush. You know, orders the murder of how many, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 Iraqis in trying to do something over there with this action of his. Not very violent, huh? Doesn't sound that way to me. You know, it sounds like they got the wrong idea.
The other point is that the serotonin level in somebody's brain can fluctuate over a very wide range without there being anything wrong with the person physically.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, and indeed, if you got inner city youth that are, if anybody is oppressed, they're naturally going to have lower levels. You know, if that's indeed the way it all...
Yeah, if it actually works this way, right.
So serotonin, again, is the neurotransmitter that is affected by psychedelic drugs. The drugs, so-called insight, are actually affecting the serotonin pathways. They're, you generally... what we call a serotonin agonist, meaning that it increases the effects of serotonin activity in your brain. So, yeah, it is, when you're getting into brain chemistry, you're getting into some very, what do we want to call it, unsteady ground.
Definitely. You know, this is very important to most of these researchers. Try to make a case for something dramatic because their funding comes on the basis of results. You know, this is not the picture that we used to have of scientists, where a scientist would say, I'm going to investigate this question in the lab for the next 6 months or a year or 3 years and find out whatever I can find out, including the possibility that I can't find out anything, which means that with our current knowledge, we just don't know. This is not really acceptable anymore.
No.
We want results. It's all result-driven, because what happens when you get a result is we get a drug. And since the pharmaceutical companies are funding so much of the research, it's all aimed at this. And the FDA is standing by in the wings that when the studies begin and they need to be okayed on a new drug for which very slim research has been done, and it's a whole situation of we don't really know what we're doing, but we think we know what we're doing, and let's just ram this through and get it out in the marketplace. The FDA is there to assure everybody a smooth passage in most cases, instead of, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And in fact, there's been something wrong for the last 40 years that we've been routinely overlooking, because you guys are, you know, you only know a quarter of what you say you know.
The original name was the Pure Food and Drug Act, and it was set up to supply, or to make sure that what it said was on the label was what you were getting. And it was left up to medical profession or, the individual to decide whether or not this is safe and effective. And somewhere along the line, the FDA got into the business of deciding if things are safe and effective. And in doing that, it's fallen prey to moneyed interests, basically. You have to have the money to get the research done. And if you've got that kind of money invested, how much more does it, you're investing $100 million to approve a drug. And if it turns out that the drug is neither safe nor effective, it's only going to cost you maybe a couple of million dollars more to grease the pockets of the right people, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people can turn down $1 million?
It's a very dangerous situation, absolutely. You're working with people who, don't really have any control over their own sense of morality, where they can say stop. Most people are just unable to do that in this whole profession, whether it's the researchers or the FDA analysts or the people that pass on the studies. By and large, 98% of these people are morally incapable of standing up and saying stop, this is wrong, I'm going to go public, I'm going to blow the whistle. There's too much fear and money and all of that sort of thing involved.
Well, even if you don't lose your job with the FDA for doing something like that, you're certainly not going to get hired by a pharmaceutical company when you retire.
Yeah, they're not going to be running after you, to hire you for anything. Yeah, so the situation that we're left with here is that we get these drugs that seem to produce the symptoms of what they're trying to cure, whether it's Ritalin producing hyperactivity eventually, or whether it's Prozac producing some sort of violent activity.
It's kind of a natural sorting process, in that the drugs become successful either because they're effective, like antibiotics, if there's an example of something,
mm-hmm.
Or because they actually produce the symptoms,
right,
that
they're supposed
to treat. And so if that does happen, then it naturally selects that drug towards more prescriptions and more acceptance by
the establishment. My understanding is that the original Pure Food and Drug Act was the FDA would decide the content of substances and whether or not there was anything poisonous about them. That was the idea. And this was because there were some heavy snake oil salesmen around,
right.
Who were not just adulterating things, but using poisonous substances and saying that these were cure-alls. So fine, that whole hysteria was cooled off by the idea of having these people who would decide, is it pure, what's in it, is it adulterated, is it poisonous? And that was the case up until 1962. The Harris Amendment, I think it was actually called the Kefauver-Harris Amendment in 62, suddenly put in the FDA's hands the decision as to whether or not these drugs were any good, whether they worked, whether they had efficacy, as they say. Now they were in the business of being the arbiter of all scientific and medical truth concerning these particular substances and devices, too, medical devices. This is a horrendous amount of responsibility to put on some agency's shoulders. And so since that's happened, you know, we've gotten just, I mean, a landslide of more horrendous compounds coming onto the market through here.
The snake oil salesman kind of took over the show.
Yeah. Organized snake oil nests through the pharmaceutical companies, because the majority of these drugs, the overwhelming majority, are unnecessary. They're just spin-offs of other drugs, you know, they're not really doing anything new, but they're a new way to hype a drug through the salespeople to doctors. And then there are a certain percentage of the drugs that are actively very harmful. Another very good example of this is AZT, the government-approved drug for AIDS, another extremely harmful drug which produces the symptoms that it's supposed to be remedying in some way.
And that came out of chemotherapy research, as I understand it.
That's right.
Which is another case where the FDA approves drugs that are lethal, that, I guess they are getting a little more refined in their application of these things, but they're not getting cures. The cure rate is not significantly higher than people who don't take it, for a lot of the things that they've been using it for.
There was a book written, I think it's 2 years ago now, by a German. His last name is Abel. He's a biostatistician who was the big guy, or one of the big guys in Germany, who was always around when they were doing cancer studies. They would call him in to look at the statistics and see whether anything was successful in the way of a new chemotherapy drug. And he took off a year or two, read all of the literature on chemotherapy, wrote a book, and came to the devastating conclusion that for 80% of organic cancers, meaning, or what they call advanced epithelial cancers, where there's been a reoccurrence of, say, a tumor after surgery was done, that sort of thing. In other words, we're talking about a major number of the kinds of terminal cases where people actually die eventually. The use of chemotherapy is completely unproven insofar as extending survival value or quality of life. And he published this book, and it caused a furor, because they were in the middle, or just about to put on, a huge cancer convention, 10,000 people from all over the world. And one of the leading guys in Germany, oncologist by the name of Hossfeld, I believe, was interviewed by Der Spiegel, the sort of Time magazine of Germany, and he said, you know, our estimates of chemotherapy were up in the sky somewhere, and the reality is much lower than we originally thought. Now, this story didn't even get into the newspapers over here in any significant way. Nobody pays any attention to it. The FDA continues to just sort of okay these drugs like clockwork, no problem. And one of the more amazing sort of side stories on this is that the major producer of chemotherapy in the world is Squibb Bristol Myers. They control maybe 50% of all the chemotherapy in the world they release. Now, when they merged, the two chairmen of the boards of those companies sat on the board of Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Institute, which is the biggest cancer research institute in the world, the most important one. So we know what the future of cancer research at Sloan Kettering is going to be, is more chemotherapy drugs. Now, in this beautiful little framework, David Kessler, the head of the FDA, comes along and makes this really tough speech to state attorney generals around the country, saying that in his administration, the FDA is going to enforce criminal prosecution on people, you know. He says, for example, let me tell you what we did to Squibb Bristol Myers. They were putting out this, really an advertisement and labeling it a medical brochure, and we took this right off the market, you know. We're really tough. Well, what about all the chemotherapy? What about the 80% of advanced epithelial cancers for which it's completely irrelevant, doesn't do any good? What about all that information? What about suing Squibb Bristol Myers? What about taking them to court? What about class action suits against these drugs? What about all of these things? Not a word. Nothing. Zero. But yet, Kessler likes to, you know, characterize himself as a very tough warrior who's going to go out there and protect the consumer on behalf of their health.
Protect us from ourselves, I guess.
Indeed.
Well, so we have the FDA approving chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy is the epitome of allopathic medicine, I guess. The idea being that disease process is some outside entity that invades your body, and in order to fight it, you must use some kind of toxic substance that kills the disease before it kills the patient. And with chemotherapy, that therapeutic range, the difference between a supposedly therapeutic dose and a lethal dose, is very, very narrow. And so, in other words, they're totally destroying the immune systems of the patients. Their hair falls out, their cells don't divide properly. And, you know, I think it's even established that people who take chemotherapy long enough or use radiation enough will actually develop cancer from the drug.
Right. In some cases, this is true. And, you know, to differentiate, to know where chemotherapy could be applicable, and I'm not certainly an expert on this, and then the overwhelming number of types of cases of cancer where it isn't applicable, you would think that some agency like the FDA would make this possibly their number one priority, considering how much chemotherapy is being used in the United States.
And how much it costs.
And how much it costs, and the billion-dollar industry that it's all this sort of thing. You hear zero from them. So now you know what level of concern they really have about protecting the consumer. It operates within this extremely narrow range. They're afraid that because 18 people took vitamin A last year in such huge quantities that they died somewhere in the United States, supposedly, that therefore they have a mandate to stage a vendetta on the food supplement industry. And because a certain number of people died from a contaminated batch of L-tryptophan, which is an amino acid substance.
Which, in fact, is a precursor to serotonin.
Serotonin, right. Another interesting point there, that they should take all tryptophan off the market, even though they have absolutely narrowed it down to a contaminated batch made by one manufacturer in Japan. The people didn't die from ingesting tryptophan, which they've been doing in health food stores forever. It was from the contamination of that batch, but they use that as an occasion to take these substances off the shelf and not return them, not right. Bring them back.
It's definitely not a safe and sane world out there when it comes to trying to figure out how to stay healthy, is it?
No, you have to be smart and you have to educate yourself. And this is what we're trying to do.
And hopefully, we are getting the message across to you folks out there. We're at the end of our second half hour. I'm really excited about the conversation. I hope you guys are. we'll just take it away from here and be back with you next time. Thanks a lot.